lot.
Right.
Really a lot.
Right.
And then there's another organization that the older guys are part of, like the Maggio and those fellows.
Right. Sugar Raggiola does a lot.
Well, Gaggiola's with Bat.
Bat, right, yeah.
But there's another separate, an older thing, American Association of Professional Baseball Players, something like that, that also does something for the still older guys. And even the union has kicked in for the younger, older guys. So, you know, there's a lot being done. They're far better off on taking care of their older people than the other sports are so far.
Oh, yeah. They're far better at all levels than the other sports. During this hockey dispute, it seemed to me that, yeah, that the hockey people were back where the baseball players were in the late 60s.
Yeah. Well, again, in this aborted strike, they didn't get the one thing that they needed to be meaningful. I mean, in my opinion, the players caved in on every point. But the essential point was a grievance procedure. They didn't get it. Without a grievance procedure, you don't have anything.
Yeah, you're shot.
Yeah, so...
That was probably one of the key things that Marvin Miller got, and one of the first things he went after.
Yeah, well, it's the key thing in any labor negotiation, because that's the only weapon a union has, a mechanism for making its case not to the employer, but to a third party. That's what grievance is. So if you don't have that, you don't have anything. You know, just in the same old tug of war, yeah, if I punch you hard, nose hard enough, you'll give me something. If you punch me, I'll give you something. But that's, you know, that's not labor negotiations.
One of the things I wonder about the players in the 60s, for years, they had been willing to accept or had been gullible enough to accept the myths of the reserve clause, the impartiality of the commissioner, and Judge Cannon being their ally, and all of that. Is that gullibility an obstacle to Miller as he tried to enlighten them, or do you think that it was something he seized on and realized if they were willing to believe all this stuff, wait till I tell them what's really going on.
No, I don't think it's either thing, really. I think you can't approach this subject at all without taking full cognizance of the differences in the outside life climate that evolved through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. This is not an isolated cocoon of baseball negotiations. This is happening in the real world to people who have gone through high school, some college, worked for employers, whose fathers, brothers belong to unions or don't belong to unions. You have to put it in the context of America in the evolving 50s and 60s to understand what changed that made it possible for Miller to come in. So your starting point is, until World War II, by and large, in the psychology of America, there is no questioning in the ordinary person's mind that a boss is a boss and an employer does what he says. And any attempt to go beyond that is radicalism. So in the 1880s, when the players tried to have a rudimentary union, in 1910, when they tried to have a rudimentary union, it was so far out of the mainstream thinking that it never got off the ground. Now, what happened in the war, by means of the war, was a tremendous awakening of the reality of new relationships. Several things happened at once. The war on the heels of the New Deal is the beginning of a civil rights movement. It's the beginning of acknowledging, hey, you know, black people exist. 12 million people were in service during World War II. And of the 12 million, I know the exact numbers, but I would think at least 10 of the 12 million were enlisted personnel who found out what it is to have to follow orders blindly and came back to civilian life saying, fuck you. You may be my boss, you're not my commanding officer. Right. So that the union movement explodes. Everybody joins a union in every industry. Right. The third thing that happened is, finally the Depression is over, runaway affluence. Now, the mature ball players of 1940, when Murphy in Pittsburgh tried to form a union, he was dealing basically with people in their 30s who had had their schooling and ideas formed early in the Depression, whose parents and teachers had pre-World War I ideas. So then the idea of playing ball, joining a union, you know, has nothing to do with each other. What they, all of them, understood instantly, having been in the Army, or having had brothers who were in the Army, was, hey, there's only one good thing about the Army, you get a pension when you get out. So pension was the magic word of the 1950s, in all industries, for all unions, but something baseball players particularly could relate to. Remember now in 1948-49, the football players are still playing for so many bucks a game. The NBA has just been formed. There's no real pro basketball. Right. Baseball players are the only real pros on the sports field. And the one thing that distinguishes them from other entertainers is, when you get to be 35, you're finished. So pension was an important thing to them. So right away, their leaders, guys like Kiner, who were big people, right away they said, hey, look, we got to have a good pension plan. They're not thinking union, they're thinking pensions. They make a deal for the World Series money, they form a pension committee, and they call it a players association. But it's really a pension committee, that's all it is. And that operates for about 10 years. Now, the canon phenomenon, canon comes out of that. Canon is the natural successor to an advisor for the pension committee. They hired a lawyer for a while, Norman Lewis, and Norman Lewis said, hey, you know, you ought to have more than a pension. And I said, get rid of this bum. And get rid of him. Because they still didn't see themselves as employees working for an employer. They were baseball players and this was the boss. So they bought into the old system because that's all they'd ever heard. That's all the fans ever heard. That's all I ever heard. That's all writers ever heard. So there wasn't any, there were a few books being written by people who said, hey, look, this is the history of it, this is what it really is, but didn't have much effect on it. Now, you come to the 1960s, right? First of all, there's a social revolution about mores, sex and drugs. Secondly, there's the rebellion against the Vietnamese War. Right? Third, there's all the campus unrest. Fourth is Martin Luther King. And fifth, there's a whole civil rights movement in the South. Well, all that is 1963, 64, 65. Now, these, so the mature ball players, the Robin Roberts, the Jim Bunning, people like that, they are now, as adults, aware of what's going on around them in the outside world. There is, even though it's only a sprinkling, only a handful of guys so far, there are black players. And black players know all about who's taking advantage of whom. The other sports now have achieved major league status. Football, and this is a competitive business, and they see in the first half of the 60s, hey, there are two football leagues, all of a sudden here's a football player getting $700,000 deal in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
40 plays.
Yeah. See? So they're aware of all these things. That's where their views start to change. It's not that they suddenly woke up, hey, we were fed a bunch of myths. It's that bit by bit they saw everything around them changing. The climate of the country was changing. People in all walks of life were changing their ideas of what they're entitled to. So at this point, and at the same time they're having a fight over getting more pension money, which is still the only thing they're really dealing with, a little bit about what the meal money should be, a little bit about the spring training expenses and so forth.
If the owners had allayed the players' fears about how the pension fund was operated, would they have forestalled the arrival of Miller or someone like him?
They not only would have forestalled the arrival, but they would have put Miller out of business anywhere along the line in the first 5 or 6 years simply by giving a decent amount. They created the union by their resistance to what were obviously minimal and legitimate demands. So the position they find themselves in 1966 is, first of all, they have the example of the football players. It's a big, big thing.
Yeah.
Of the two leagues, which have just merged. Secondly, they have the example of the basketball players, who don't have much and are an inferior sport. Whoever pays attention to basketball, we just saw that the minute they threatened to strike the 1965 playoffs, they got everything they've been asking for 10 years of getting brushed off. Made an impression. So they're still not thinking union because they don't have that context. But our Players Association, which looks after our pension and minimum salary and a couple of other little things like that, it needs better direction than we're getting. So there's a disillusionment with Cannon, not because there's anything wrong with Cannon as a person, but Cannon represents the point of view if we're part of this establishment. It's like, let's find somebody better. Somebody recommends Miller. Roberts goes to talk to him. Yes? Is that somebody at the door?
Let me see. Sure.
At that point, the idea that, if he's a good friend of the ownership, they'll do us a favor, has been disproved so many times, they say, hey, look, this isn't the way to go. We need something better than this. So they get to Miller. Now, they don't know what they're getting when they get Miller.
Right.
They just think they're going to have a more effective executive director of the Players Association.
They're getting an expert in the field.
Well, they're not even sure what the field is.
Right.
Just someone who is not the creature of the people they're trying to make headway against. Miller comes in, and right away, Miller comes in with his ideas full blown. I mean, Miller understands and believes from day one, look, if these are employees, these are their employers, if the employees want the better deal, this is how you have to go about it. All the traditional union views. Good faith, hard bargaining, be prepared to bargain, decide what you're going to stick up for, what you're going to give up, etc., 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 etc. We'll find out what's important. And Miller starts the process of educating them. First, he educates the small group that hired him. Gradually, as he goes around and talks to each club, he educates more and more. But now, in 1966 and 67, Think who Miller is talking to now. The 25-year-olds. 25-year-olds in 1967 were in high school in 1957. They're a different generation. They're not even the baby boom yet.
Right.
The 30-year-old guy and the 35-year-old guy as an adult has seen everything around him in the process of change. He's seen marches in the South, he's seen this thing, the other thing, that's it, et cetera, et cetera. So they're in a better position to be receptive than the guys in 1946 were. It's a different group. And the one thing that's clear in their eyes is, you know, in 1966, $5,000 is not a decent minimum wage. The other thing that happened during the 60s, to a small degree compared to later, but to a discernible degree, was inflation. The fact of it was a slow inflation, but it was constant. The fact that things cost more year after year was already in people's minds. There were such things as cost of living provisions in other union contracts. So there, we got ours in 1946. It's out of step.
Right.
So this makes them receptive to what Miller then begins to teach them. As I'm sure you've seen, if you look at the first issue, I got ahead of myself. The first issue, of course, is, should it be a union? And if I say, yeah, I guess maybe it should, because nothing else has worked. Let's have a union. I say, okay, if you got a union, you have to pay dues. And the coach say, ah, that's easy, boy. They'll never pay dues. So the first issue is setting up the withholding of dues. And they win that. They win it, I think, for a very simple reason, basically that it's almost unsustainable under the law to resist it at that time.
Yeah, they did a whole dance around...
Yeah, right. Okay, but now Miller starts. If you look at the things that were won in the 1967 First Players Agreement, if you look at that list, you find there are things like a few more dollars of meal money. Please don't make us play a doubleheader after a night game. Have towels in the locker room. That kind of. A little more meal money, a little stipulation while you're not paying us in spring training, what our expense money should be. They were very mundane, trivial things, but grievance procedure,
right?
And that's the nub. That's always the nub. From that point on, there's a succession of grievances that gradually shift decision-making power in a dispute from the commissioner, who's an employee of the clubs, to an arbitrator, who hears the grievance.
Yeah. How big?
And more things in subsequent negotiations shift from the commissioner's jurisdiction to the arbitrator's jurisdiction.
And I talked with Marvin Miller about that, about the effect of the Flood lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. Now, everything I said up to now is before that.
Right.
We're not up to Flood yet.
Right, I know. How important that was, because Kuhn and the baseball people went on record as disavowing the premise of impartiality.
They lost
impartiality.
Baseball lost the essence of the Flood suit while apparently winning it.
Yeah.
By the assertions they had to make in order to win it. The key assertion being, yes, free agency is a matter of bargaining. Once they said that, free agency was gone. from their control. It still existed until he negotiated something, but it was out of their control at that point. In order to keep it, then, immediately, they adopted salary arbitration.
Right.
Salary arbitration with the reserve system is a reasonable process.
Right.
Free agency and salary arbitration are contradictory. Marvin was smart enough to steer away from total free agency because he saw the advantages. Now, there are people in Fair's office now who will tell you, in retrospect, they're not so sure he foresaw everything so clearly and that he sort of lucked into it. I don't believe that, because I was there and I remember how early we talked about what. I believe he did foresee that total free agency would do them far less good than create the limited market that the deal may finally be.
If somebody besides Charlie Finley had screamed, let them all be free agents, do you think
No, I don't think that. I don't think it would have made any difference, because the proof of it is
done by then.
No, the proof of it is it's now 17 years later and they still haven't done it.
Yeah.
I mean, if they wanted to do it, they could do it anytime. Right? The union can't reject it. If they go to the party and they say, hey, you want to make everybody free agent? The union can't say, no, we won't let you. So, in my opinion, this is just my personal opinion, is they'll give you 1,000 rationalizations. But the real force that keeps them married to controlling players from year to year is that a totally free market would put such pressure on the judgment of general managers that nobody wants to face it. See, the old reserve system was the greatest excuse and cop-out in the world. We can't get Stan Musial, who belongs in St. Louis. We can't get Joe DiMaggio, who belongs in the Yankees. Trades, oh yeah, trades. But the very concept of a trade is presumably both sides think they're getting something, or they don't do it. Right? So, again, there's no pressure of evaluation. Every general manager is in a position, well, I'm doing the best I can with what we got. Now, if every year you had to say, hey, look, like rotisserie, right? Here's the whole list. Now, you pick the 25 guys you want. And only one of you can win. And only four of you can finish first. They don't want any part of that. And it's so ingrained in them that they don't even realize that that's what's motivating. They wouldn't say so in a conversation. They don't think so. They think of themselves as pretty sharp-minded, tough-minded people. Especially the ones who are ball players and are very competitive people. But at bottom, that's what they don't want to face. And their staffs don't want to face it. And they convince their owner that it's something that wouldn't be good for the owner. Now, they're not all that way. They're already, in my opinion, they're probably, of the 26 clubs, they're probably at least 8 right now who would opt for total free agency.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Especially the younger general managers.
Could think they can out...
No, because they see the consequences of not doing it. They're not so lacking in confidence, but not so much that they're lacking in confidence, but that they're less lacking in confidence, but they've seen with their own eyes what this system produces, and see that there's no end to it. Unless you make them all free agents.
There's no, as long as the money's there.
No, it doesn't matter what the money is. As long as they're not all free agents, it'll ratchet itself up, because as long as some of them aren't free agents, there's no way to get rid of the arbitration. And the arbitration and the free agent and the arbitration.
They build on each other.
See, what I think was a very significant sequence in developments, this is partly historical accident, it had a very great effect. Catfish Hunter's case came up a year before. Now, the essence of the Catfish Hunter case was that there had been a long-standing provision in the rules that if a player is not paid, and this goes back to minor league clubs running out on their obligations. Remember Casey Stengel used to talk about the uniform he took home when the Kankakee Club went bust in 1910? Well, players used to not get paid. So in dealing with that, back in the 1920s and 30s, they put a provision in the rule book says that if a club doesn't play a player that violates the contract, then he's free. He's free. What grew out of that was a two-pronged provision as time went on. It said, okay, you can accept the back pay owed you and have the contract remain in force. Or you can be a free agent. Well, Hunter had that option. And Dick Morse and Marvin saw it and advised him, you're better off being a free agent than simply taking the back money that Charlie owns you. Now, so Hunter was, in that effect, an accidental free agent. Nobody intended him to be a free agent in the dealings, but it came out that way. Now, here's a free agent. He's the first free agent in the history of baseball. Right? And 24 clubs compete for his services. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, he's got a contract. He's got a five-year contract. First of all, nobody ever had a five-year contract. But the total value of that five-year contract is at least 10 times the biggest previous contract. Well, no, that's not true. Hank Aaron had a three-year $600,000. So it's five times.
Yeah.
And why did this happen? Because there was one player and 24 clubs. Now, that set in motion two things. One is, hey, look, the provision that makes you a free agent can be used. In other words, a legal situation where your contract has been abrogated makes a man a free agent. Okay? Well, let's look at that contract again. Let's look at that option clause. What it says is 1 year. So they took that to a grievance. Couldn't do it without a grievance procedure. Took that to a grievance, really, and won hands down. While that was in progress, they were negotiating a new player agreement. And what was on the table, what they were asking for, was free agency after 10 years. So 10 years may be a free agent. Now, if the clubs had given them that at that point, that's the end of that. Now, at the same time, on a parallel track from the Hunter case, say, hey, look. And we wrote this at the time. I mean, I remember writing columns about it. Say, look, you can't take the Hunter case as an example of what would happen if players were free agents. Because here's one guy who's the biggest star of all already, and 24 clubs bidding for his services, sure he's going to get $3 million. If there were a lot of pitchers out there and a lot of clubs playing for him, no one guy would. Well, that registered. See, they thought the same thing. That's what Marvin figured out, too. Hey, look, if everybody's a free agent, everybody's scrambling for jobs. is to our interest if only a certain number, or if there are fewer free agents available, then
supply and demand.
Supply and demand. So, as I recall it, his book will tell you what it actually did, but as I recall, the sequence of events and the reasoning went something like this. The site's decision has come down, and the court has upheld it. And the players are saying, "Wee, goody, goody, at the end of this season I'll be a free agent." Marvin is saying to them, not so fast. You know, think about it. You've got something to gain from accepting certain limitations. To the club owners, he's saying, look, the law now says they're free agents. I can't stop them from being free agents. If I do, they'll sue me. I'm supposed to be representing them. I have no right to suggest that they're not free agents. Now, we'll talk. If I can get them to come in with a proposal, okay. So, they straighten it out inside the place, say, yeah, I see what you mean. Comes back to the bargaining table and says, tell you what we'll do. We want, at the end of 5 years, everybody's a free agent. No, 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 how about six? Okay, we'll take six. And they didn't say that, hey, they said it that way. Wait, wait a minute, but what about arbitration? What about arbitration?
Separate.
Most of my players aren't free agents. They need arbitration just as much as they ever did when nobody was a free agent.
He had them.
And he had them. Now, any point after that, at any point after that, it was completely within their power to say, hey, fuck it. Everybody's a free agent. Not the first 2 years. You know, give us a chance to find out if a guy can play. That's totally reasonable. And that would be that.
I've always seen Miller as a counterpuncher. Your comments suggest that he was more... that his strategies were more planned and foreseen.
No, I think Miller's concepts and intentions and tactics and strategies were always clear in his mind. The fact is, he would have lost every battle if the opposition hadn't won it for him by taking a ridiculous position.
They made it easy for him.
Yeah, they radicalized his membership in his favor by the position and the statements they took.
Right from the start.
Every step of the way. They would have little grievances about a guy not getting his expense money when traded. Right? They would oppose the grievance. They would let it go to an arbitrator. Now Miller goes to his next meeting with each club. He says, you see what they do? You see what they're like? You see where you'd be if we didn't stick together to stick up for ourselves? They don't even want to give you your goddamn travel money. And they did that every step of the way. The first strike, the 72 strike, was over pension allocation. Use of pension money already in the
right.
Right? Now,
as we put it here.
Miller is saying to them, in effect, hey, look, you know, if you want to stick up for this, you got to be willing to stay out. Very reluctant to stay out. And he knows that they're very reluctant to stay out. So he says, okay, we won't push it. We'll take whatever an arbitrator gives us, knowing perfectly well that arbitrators are always going to cut it down on a deal like that. Now, this is 3 days before the season starts. He says, okay, we accept. Just turn it over to an arbitrator, and the argument's over. Whatever the arbitrator says, we'll take 0, 50%, right? The owners say, no. We don't want it to go to an arbitrator. We don't want outsiders deciding our business. Go ahead and strike. Well, they've got a population of 600 guys that they scouted for their competitive instincts. What do they think is going to happen? They say, okay, you say fuck me, I say fuck you. So they're on a strike. 2 days after the season started, 2 or 3 days after the season started, and they're on strike now. The owners had a meeting at which most of them found out for the first time that they were having a strike over something that had already been yielded. There was all hell to pay in the owners' meeting. I said, what kind of bullshit is this? Straighten it out, get us back to work. We're not taking in any money. They spent the next 10 days arguing about whether they should be paid or not for the 3 days, then 4 days, 5 days that they didn't play.
Amazing, isn't it?
Right? And the same thing happened subsequently all down the line. Whenever he was in a crunch where you would say to yourself from outside, say, you know, maybe boy, players aren't going to stick together on this. The owners would do something or say something that, you know, guaranteed to make them stick to it. Or would lock them out of spring trading. There's a big punishment, lock them out of spring training. It is an emotional punishment. Players want to go to spring training. Players want to get in shape. It's baseball season, it's time to play. That's why I couldn't wait for the winter to end, because I don't like real life. I like being baseball players. But when you use it as a club, it's not much of a club. As I say, that's like saying to your 12-year-old kid, listen, what you're going to have to do is take your dinner upstairs in a tray, sit in your room, and watch television.
Right.
You know. Okay.
You wrote in 1967, the burden of reasonableness is on the owners.
Absolutely.
It still is, and they're still fighting it.
Well, not so much now, because right now the relative strengths have tilted so far that there's nothing unreasonable about what the owners would like to see now. They would like to, what the owners would like to see right now is freezing. Now that's not unreasonable when the players are now getting 50% of the take instead of 17% that they were getting then. And where they have all kinds of protections, like a year's salary if you're cut, and, you know, and all the other regulations that are in there about scheduling and disabled lists and blah, 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 and grievance procedure. So the owners are not any longer in an unreasonable position from an outside point of view. What they had for 100 years was unreasonable. That's why the burden of proof was on them. To say that I belong to you for life after my contract runs out is unreasonable. To say, hey, let's make some arrangement where you know, the salaries don't escalate so much, that's not unreasonable. Maybe you can get it, maybe you can't get it. You know, you can argue about who deserves what, but it's not unreasonable. So they're no longer in an unreasonable situation. They're in an irrational situation, because they keep doing what's harmful to themselves. They just did it again last week with the fight with the commissioner, over the commissioner. And you say to yourself, the only issue, absolutely the only issue that they're facing is the next negotiation in which they're planning a lockout. Now, it's been true from the beginning. If they're willing to stay shut for half a season, players will give in. There's no question of that. But they have to show that they're determined to stay shut. Now, every time they show that they're not, in order to stay shut, they have to all stay shut. To all decide to stay shut. Right?
Yeah.
Now, they're talking big. They hired this guy, Ravitch. They're going to try to convince the players that this time we mean it, this time we'll stick to it. Right? Now they go have a squabble among themselves between the guy they hired and the commissioner. Well, if they can't stick together on that, they're going to stick together to cut off their own income. So they've already lost the next negotiation.
They've always done that.
Yeah, they've always done it.
If they had had strike insurance for the full 81 season, they would have stayed out. They would.
I don't think so. I don't think that's it. You know, the strike insurance was a method of bookkeeping. It's deferred payment. When you take out what they didn't pay the players and this, that, that was not the issue in 81, in my opinion. In my opinion, in 81, is, after all, I said, why did they have strike insurance that only lasted 2 months? I think the driving force in 81 was, after all, 81 was a replay of what was supposed to happen in 80.
Right.
Right? And in 80, it was supposed to start earlier than it did. Supposed to start May 23rd, something like that.
Right.
I think the driving force in that situation was, we cannot afford as an industry not to have a player from the World Series. We can afford to play a hell of a lot less than 160 games. We can't afford to blow a World Series. We can't afford it with television. We can't afford it with the public. We can't afford it with our ticket selling practices. We can't afford it. So what was hanging over the 1981 strike from the beginning is, one way or another, we've got to get back into action in time to have a World Series. And that doesn't mean there's a particular date, but it does mean you can't come back a week before. You know, you got to have enough competition. So the insurance that they bought, the 2 months of insurance that they bought, was the extent to which they were willing to test the will of the players. There wasn't one of them who didn't believe to the bottom of his shoes, well, after the second week they'll be back. The minute they miss one paycheck, they'll come crawling back. Didn't turn out that way after the first paycheck. Didn't turn out that way after the second paycheck. By then, said, well, we might as well, take the rest of the insurance and see, maybe they'll give in on the third paycheck. They did. Now it became a matter of how are we gonna get the World Series in. And the only way, and it wasn't an accident, that the second half that they played was almost exactly the same length as the first half that they had played, because that was the way to get there. And I think the same thing is true now. They can't lock them out and stay shut so long that they don't have a World Series at the end. And the fact that the players know that makes it a very strong test of wills. It's one thing to say we'll have a shortened season. It's another thing to say we'll have no season. But unless they are convincing that they're willing to have no season, they're not going to win a strike.
Think they'll use the precedent of the 81 season, the number of games that were played? If they cut off the first two months of the season, you think they'll say we get
first 2 months of the season?
Well, we can still get 100 games in. You don't think
we get 100 games in? But what's different between now and 1981 is that you all need revenue much more desperately than they needed in 1981. If they're paying the players five times as much, so that they're paying the players more for half a season. But they don't pay them while they're out, right?
Yeah.
But they could pay them more for half a season than they used to pay for the whole season.
Will the
right?
Will the TV networks have stipulations in the next contract that?
In this contract, they won't collect their TV money if they don't play. So. They'll collect their World Series money when they get there, if it's a valid World Series. But in order to get there, you got to play. On top of that, in my opinion, I haven't checked this out with anybody, But you can check it out with lawyers and ask the players. I say, it seems to me any player who's got a multi-year contract that they lock out can sue the shit out of them. I mean, I'm ready to play. Well, our camp is closed. Well, you gave me a guaranteed contract.
Sounds right.
You know. So, and you also cut into my earning power for ancillary income because you're not letting me perform my duties. So I don't believe there'll be a lockout. I believe it's all posture. Well, again, we'll go through the same holy mess during spring training. And we may have a 2 or 3 week delay at the beginning of the season. But I don't believe for one moment that they're either willing or capable of shutting down and saying, okay, season's canceled. Don't do that. And players know they wouldn't do it.
Ah, which brings up 69 and the holdout and the boycott.
69. This is the maneuver. Don't sign your contracts.
Right. Because they haven't figured out where the new TV money is going. Whether that TV formula will be
by the pensions. It's basically a pension.
Right.
It's basically a pension. Right. At that point, still, the pension is the only thing the players are willing to fight for.
Right.
Emotion. It's the only thing that really matters. And they. They make it sick. What happened in 69 was really a mishmash of a lot of things that were interrelated. It was not a clear-cut labor question. What happened in 69 was, at the end of 68,
Can you hang on one second?
Is my view of it. It's not necessarily going to coincide with documentation or what somebody else thinks or what a historian might write. These are just my personal impressions. Then at the end of 68, you get into this hassle where they've made a terrible mistake about the commissionership. And it's wrecking them, and they got to dump Becker, and they got to get a new commissioner. This is early December 1968. And they find themselves in a complete stasis, but that's not the right word. Dead opposition between the two leagues. There's no way the American League is going to let a National League be the commissioner again, as Frick was. There's no way the National League is going to let an American League be a commissioner. We tried an outsider, and it turned out to be Ecker.
Yeah.
So they had this terrible internal warfare about the commissionership, which ends up in February, the beginning of February, with, well, let's let Bowie, who we all know, who's our lawyer, let's let Bowie handle the office for a while until we figure out a way to straighten this out. So on February 4th, they named Bowie Commissioner Pro Tem. And they meant pro tem. And for Christ's sake, a minute of this, that's why it was unanimous. Because they weren't giving him the power. They were saying, run the routines of the commissioner's office for us, and we'll figure out a better way to vote with politics. We'll see who we can come up with as a permanent commissioner. At that point, the let's not sign our contracts thing, which the players are doing on their own track, is already in motion. Bowie, in my opinion, his life changed the first time a flashbulb went off in his face. He's commissioner, he liked it. Okay. And he was very highly praised by me and everybody else when he was named commissioner. It looked like a very constructive step, given the circumstances. Now he's commissioner. And Bowie, like any intelligent man, he is an intelligent man, he say, hey, I'm commissioner of baseball, and if baseball isn't going on, what am I commissioner of? So all of a sudden, Bowie, who had spent all his time up to that time fighting Miller across the bargaining table and taking antitrust cases under a legal exemption, all of a sudden finds, hey, this thing is starting to fall apart. I got to do something. So what he did was say, never mind whether he signed contract or not, open the training camp. Now, he did that, and I think he did it sincerely. He did that as the proper thing for a commissioner to do. A commissioner is supposed to keep baseball going. So, if there had been a commissioner in place all along, I doubt that the not signing contracts ploy would have worked, because they would have been in the same position as individual holdouts. Okay, you want to hold out? Hold out. Joe DiMaggio held out. Baseball went on.
Colfax and Drysdale.
A bunch of other people held out. Baseball went on. 100 guys want to hold out? Hold out. We'll have training camp without you. What do we care? But it wasn't the continuing position where there was a unified leadership of owners and commissioner. They themselves were fragmented. And the commissioner they had appointed had to do what seemed right for the commissioner to do. Our first job is to play baseball games. So that evaporated. It turned out to be, again, a backhanded victory for the union. Because it made them feel, hey, you know, we did something.
Exactly. I have it noted as a Pyrrhic victory for Kuhn. He saved the moment.
Yeah. Well, I think he did the right thing, but it wasn't the only thing he did, remember. He did two other things. He stuck his nose into the Clendenin case, and he stuck his nose into the Staub case.
Well, those were
Harrelson. No. Staub and Clendenin
were two parts of the same.
But not really, because they were different. They were different issues.
Yeah.
See? So, the Harrelson case comes later. It comes during the season.
Right.
Again, that's against what the owners want the commissioner to do. But what else could he do? After all, his first job as commissioner, which he knew better than anybody else, with his background, was supposed to stay out of court. Well, they would have hauled him into court in 10 seconds if he hadn't done what he did.
Well, Hoffheinz was ready to.
No, I mean the players.
Oh, the players.
The players would have hauled him into court. But the owners can't take him to court. The owners have signed a document saying they're not going to take him to court. They can bluster and threaten and...
Is that what Hoffheinz was doing? Blustering?
Sure. The point is, now he's involved himself on the players' side as it looks to the players.
Yeah.
Right? And that's all the owners need to see. He's on the players' side. Right? So now, on the heels of this, at the end of the season, comes Flood. Now, aside from everything else, aside from Bowie's own predilection, aside from sincere belief in reserve clauses and something very fundamental had changed between February and December. What had changed was, in August, they made him not pro tem, but full-time commissioner. He lobbied for it, he politicked for it, he made enemies getting it, he held them up for more money, he made them restore 7 years instead of 4 years to the term they had adopted, and he won, but that was a Pyrrhic victory, because from that point on, he had undying enemies among the owners. Some owners were glad to coalesce behind him, especially O'Malley, whose pawn he was. But some other owners, okay, fella.
Finley,
those games were played. So from that point on, there was a nucleus of resistance within the group. So now when it comes to, now all of a sudden here's the antitrust case against, here's Flood bringing up his issue. Among other things, Bowie now has to be purer than Caesar's wife to the owners. Right? He has to show them he's not a players' commissioner. Now he's still trying to tell the players, look, look what I did for you last spring, I'm your guy. Too bad, Bowie, what did you do for us lately? You know, and the whole thing now. The players did not want, I don't believe, Flood to go ahead. Players still didn't believe they could get that way. And I don't, and I know that Marvin certainly didn't believe that if they forced things to a strike at that point, that they could stick together in a strike and win a strike. He knew that
a strike
over
the reserve.
Over any issue. Right. Any issue. You know, they just weren't there yet.
Right.
They hadn't, they weren't that edge and they weren't that close. But they couldn't afford to have Flood do it on his own, on some lawyer they didn't know, and lose. Because then they're stuck with his loss. So once they convinced themselves, they didn't all convince themselves so easily, but once enough of them convinced themselves, hey, look, he means it. He's really going to do this, whether we help him or not. We better get on board, and we better take control of the case than some lawyer in St. Louis. So now they go into it. They know they have no case. They know that all that can happen is make a record to work its way up to the Supreme Court. And there's no, there isn't any ambiguity that baseball is exempt from any antitrust laws. What you're doing is, for the first time, you're having a trial record on the issue that with a grandstanding judge who can say at the end of, you know, I've given this a great deal of thought and I've decided it's not my jurisdiction. Knew that before he started. Right?
Yeah.
And you know the appeals court is going to buck it up. So you know it's going to be, it's going to go on for a while. Right? But in the meantime, you're still having labor negotiations. Apart from this. Right? And in the course of the trial, I think, in my personal opinion, again, just my personal opinion, the players at the time paid very little attention to the trial. As I recall it, not one player who was in town showed up to watch it.
Right.
Now, part of that is, I don't want to antagonize my owner by, you know, by being prominent. But beyond that, they really didn't seem to be much interested in just talking to them.
Yeah, Miller counts that as a big mistake.
They weren't much interested in it.
They're not drumming up some interest.
Yeah, but I also believe that after the trial, it started to sink in. Bit by bit, they heard people talking about They read articles here and there about some of the things that was said in that trial. And they said, hey, wait a minute. What kind of bullshit? And after all, there were many people testifying in the trial that had great respect, like Beck, like Greenberg, who said, yeah, you know, this is outrageous. This shouldn't be. There should be something worked out. That helped prepare the players to say, hey, we can get this at the negotiating table. We can get something. And as I say, they came in with a proposal for it. But Miller, again, very astutely, in my view, went for, he gave them a choice. He said, look, you don't want to loosen the reserve clause? At least give us salary arbitration. That's the concept. Now, they had already committed themselves in briefs that it's a subject of bargaining. Right? So they can't say we don't want to hear about it. So you say to them, well, you don't want to do this, then you got to do one or the other. He said, okay, we'll take the other, we'll take the arbitration. Along with it, he got, again, he concentrated on details. 5 and 10. 10-year player, 5-year same club, can't be traded without his approval. It's a little niche in the total control for it.
Mm-hmm.
Make the severance pay last a little longer. 60 days instead of 30 days. Really half a season. Really, if he's there opening day, it ought to be the whole season. And gradually they're working towards things like that. But basically, the arbitration, after all, is only another feature of the grievance procedure. It's another mechanism like a grievance procedure. And the central force of the whole thing is to be able to take grievance to an outside party. Since they're starting from a position of zero in terms of rights before the union began, right? Since they're starting a position where clubs have total autocratic control, the players have nothing, and the very small fraction of the pie, right? Obviously, if you take anything to a reasonable outsider, you're going to win 90% of the time. Now, that wouldn't be true today if you took things to a reasonable outsider.
Right.
Right? Because
they're about even.
Because now it's a fairly even fight. Right? But at that point, you got to, just the existence of grievance makes you win everything. Because your grievances are all legitimate.
Yeah. I think if Miller had represented the American Indians, they'd be running the Dakotas and Montana.
No, not unless
the president were
the
like
president
the
and Congress
like the
were
owners.
Like club owners.
Right.
And they weren't.
Right. But the players are the one exploited group who've gotten reparations and then some.
Well, the players are no longer an exploited group.
Right.
It's that simple. The players, in my opinion, short-sightedly, are pushing a thing too far, pushing a good thing too far. Because what happened in the process, the free agency, which Miller was always dead against, is still dead against to this day, was you introduced a third element, which is the agent. The agent has his own agenda. You say about a ball player, say, holy cow, he's making $3 million, and he's mad because it isn't $5 million. He can't spend three, what the hell does he need with five? The difference is $200,000 for his agent. And that's a significant amount of money for his agent. And if the agent has 10 other clients, and this is going to set the tone. Now you're talking about a couple of million dollars for the agent. Now the agent may be a lawyer, he may get a fee instead of a percentage. That's neither here nor there. The agent has a life and death motive to push that number as high as he can push it, whether the player gives a shit or not. So what does the agent do? The agent tells the player, hey look, they were insulting you by not giving you what this guy with the worst record is getting. The ball player, being a ball player, and again, having been bred and selected for his competitive instincts,
so
He says, yeah, that's right. Mark McGuire went nuts when they announced that he took a salary cut. I didn't take a salary cut. God damn it, there was a bonus provision that didn't apply. That's all. It's not a salary cut. What's involved? Nothing but pride. It has nothing to do with dollars at that level. So,
it's a far cry from, I always think of Bob Veal, 16 and 8 in 67 and took a pay cut.
Mm-hmm. Lots of
cry. Yeah, the Gehrig stories, yeah. And all those are, they're horror stories, really.
And you see, in the first place, they're not as horror at the time as they seem now in retrospect. Right. Remember, it was also
Gehrig was
a time.
In a depression.
It was also a time. No, forget the economics. It was also a time we could go to work and an employee could say, "Hey, I don't like that tie you're wearing. Out." And you were out. There was no law against it, and there was no group to protect you. So you can't separate it from the context of the time in which things happen. What you might call sort of a pervasive cultural consciousness affects everything. And it's different. We talk about the 1980s as being an era of runaway greed and so on. But that was the cultural context of that time. Yeah, greed is okay. Well, back there, what the boss says is law was okay. So it wasn't a... While it was mean, and it was shameful, and it was a cheat and all that, it wasn't quite the way it looks now. When you look at it,
right,
used to now. So, at this point, I think the real problem they face, in my opinion, is, as I say, the agents keep pushing at the ceiling, whatever the ceiling is. By and large, agents are sharper and more capable than general managers, just by the nature of the industries. Okay? So what do general managers do? They hire agents to represent them in the arbitration. And they hire the Tal Smiths. But what's happening is the agents push against the ceiling. The players get wrapped up in the ego aspect of it. Without any slightest... they're in their 20s. They don't know anything about what it used to be. They can't imagine, Jesus... Manager overheard me say something bad and tomorrow I'm in the minor leagues. It can't happen anymore. They never struggled to begin with. The Will Clark spent 2 months in the minor leagues, not 7 years. And even the minor leagues aren't as bad as they used to be. So you have this frame of mind in the players, you have the agent pushing against the ceiling. And at the same time, you have an overt, explicit, publicly announced entertainment business role for baseball as a whole. Right? You're saying frankly, oh yes, we make a lot of our money by selling shirts and caps and cards. There's a collector's market in autographs. The negotiations with the television networks are very public and much written about. The World Series games are at night. The big issue in Chicago is we have to have lights on Wrigley Field, but we can't stay there. So baseball has, and same time as football and basketball, on the same level, and the Olympics and so on, the same set that you turn your dial for a baseball game, in turn for a football game and an Olympics and everything else. So it's now accepted that they're part of show business. They always were, but it wasn't perceived that way. Now, if that's the perception, naturally, the both the performers and the producers start to act more like performers and producers in the movies, in the theater, in the music business, and everywhere else. Because, moreover, so there's no one to look at as the basketball people had to do 10 years ago. Wait a minute, what about the health of the industry? Now, I don't believe the industry is in any trouble myself. That's my opinion. But it's possible that it is. But if it is, it's because there's nobody able to act in the interest of the whole. What I think the worst feature of it is, in the long run for them, both the players and the owners, what they're doing to the fans is they've created two things, one of which is their fault and one of which isn't, that, in my opinion, are going to undermine the future of their marketability. The thing they did that's their own fault is with the free agency in the form that it is now, and with the salaries escalating as they have because of the double ratcheting, and with the constant bad-mouthing of the players by their own owners, calling them greedy bums and all that rest of it, what they've done is they disconnected the fan from the fortunes of the club. The fan used to feel that if a star player were traded for another player, if his favorite player were traded away, he might not like that and resent it, but at least the premise was he was traded so that the club I'm rooting for will get stronger. When Jack Morris decides he'd rather pitch at Toronto than Minnesota, that's not the message the Minnesota fan gets. The message he gets is, son of a bitch, abandon me.
But Bob Locker was talking about Morris today, too.
Now, what they... so you get this terrible resentment of the high-priced player, not only because it's high-priced, but because it's... he is now perceived as selfish because of, he's exercising his rights to do what's good for him. Well, as a fan, I don't want him to do what's good for him, I want him to do what's good for me.
Exactly.
Right? Now, presumably the club was doing that when they had to open it. The club wasn't. The club was screwing me and him both by doing whatever it decided to do. But at least I thought I associated myself with the club. And when all my favorite players got traded, I didn't stop being a Dodger fan. I was still a Dodger fan of the new players who put on a Dodger uniform. I'm a fan of the uniform, not of the person. Right? Now, what they've let get away from
that one, yes.
What they've let get away from them is what originally made them very successful. The thing that made professionals successful in the social context of the late 19th century, early 20th century, right down through the 1950s and 60s, was the idea conveyed to the fans, hey, these guys are playing for money, and it's important how they make out. You can be sure they're giving it their best effort all the time, because if they can get to the World Series, that's another $6,000, and that's a lot. And if they don't play well during the season, next year they're going to take a pay cut. So they're going to have to pay. In the fan's mind, the player's financial reward and his performance were connected.
Right. Especially the Yankees.
Yeah.
The Yankees
now the they're disconnected.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a way around that. I've written about it. I've made proposals. I think they have to find methods in which they make the base pay less and the prize money much more. There are different formulas by which you could do it. But you could do it. In effect, you have that in golf and tennis.
Yeah.
with the bulk of the review. You don't win, you don't make money. Now, in tennis, they get around it with exhibitions.
Right.
In golf, they get around it with supporters and, you know, a rich man
sponsors.
Wants to play around with
yeah.
you. But basically, to the fan, there's no question that the prize is by winning. That's disappeared in baseball now. The World Series prize money is 20 times what it used to be. But it used to be a large fraction of a year's income. Now it's an insignificant fraction of a year's
income. It used to be, what, 50% or more?
For most players, yeah. Most second-line players doubled their income. Now only a rookie doubles his income if he gets to the World Series with his $100,000. So having sold that to the fan, don't be surprised if the fan is upset about it. The other thing that's happened is totally out of their control, but it's very bad. And that's the conditioning of the fan, especially kids, to highlights. Baseball isn't a highlights game, but they're growing up seeing only highlights. And they're
yeah,
bored when they go to a ballpark.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very great danger to them. I don't know what you do about it. I don't know how you get around it. But it is a very great thing.
And the collector's industry has made mercenaries out of the fans. That's what bothers me.
Out of the
me.
Kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see a 10-year-old kid
yeah.
who knows that Don Mattingly's rookie card is $7,
right.
but he doesn't know that he drove in 143
right.
runs one
that's
year.
Right. Exactly.
Or why
right.
his card is valuable.
And another thing I think they're doing that is self-defeating in the long run. They don't think so. You know, this is really one man's far-out opinion. But I think that by turning the way the A's have done, by turning the ballpark into a family amusement park, what you've done is cut off the fan formation for the future. After all, if the kid you take to the ballpark now, during the game, sits behind the stands riding a hobby horse, or flipping basketballs while the game on the field is on television.